Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. We are broadcasting from the Power in Practice Alumni Workshop for Commonwealth Financial Network, taking place in Orlando, Florida. Topic now, though, is the agriculture industry. What with the trade wars between the United States and China, could farmers in the United States be affected for many years to come? Joining us now to help us answer this question is Tom Halverson. He is the president and the chief executive of CoBank. Assets under management, more than $125 billion. They are based in Denver. CoBank is one of the four banks of the Farm Credit System. It provides loans, leases, and other financial services to rural communities across the United States. Tom, thank you very much for being with us. Tell us the current state of health of the agriculture industry when it comes to growing soybeans.
Certainly, Pim, happy to do that. The fact of the matter is, you know, we are in the midst of this trade turmoil that you've been talking a great deal about as a result of negotiations that have now been underway for quite some period of time. But if you roll the tape back further, the agricultural economy of the United States started softening well back in the 2013 and 14 period. So if you look at the Department of Agriculture's own data on net farm income, for example, it's 50% lower today than it was in 2013. So before the disalignments that we've been experiencing with our NAFTA partners and with China occurred, the agricultural economy was already soft. And the consequences of the negotiations that we've been experiencing over the recent months have exacerbated that tendency as a result of the tariffs that we have imposed and the retaliatory tariffs that Mexico, Canada, and China have imposed in response. So the agricultural economy was soft before. It's softer and more vulnerable today.
So, Tom, what does that mean in terms of whether the U.S. agricultural industry is headed for a recession, whether we expect bankruptcies to pick up, as we've seen a little bit in the upper Midwest?
Well, let's step back and answer that by recognizing that the agricultural economy is one of the most positive participants in the trade balance of the United States. We have grown U.S. exports of agricultural products over the last 25 years dramatically, and it makes a very positive impact on the trade and current account balance of the country. But you're exactly right. The fact of the matter is that is manifesting itself in stress in the rural economy in a wide areas of the country. That manifests itself in stress and bankruptcies and difficulties looking in various sectors, whether it's, you know, soybean producers and growers whose markets are under stress, or dairy production complex, for example, is experiencing similar levels of stress. And then when you go up to the next level, which is the aggregators of producers' products, agricultural co-ops and the like, they may be experiencing difficulties as well. So there's belt tightening, and that means that people buy less new, you know, machinery and equipment, and they're looking for ways to reduce their costs, and they are being caught for the first time in a decade, as the rest of the economy is, in a rising interest rate environment where for many years now, interest rates weren't really a significant component of production agricultural's cost side. It's becoming much more so. So for people who entered this period with from a position of relatively high leverage, you know, that exacerbates their tensions and their credit stress.
Tom, does this uncertainty and this stress that you're describing, does it bleed over into other areas of the agriculture industry? And I'm thinking because, you know, your customers are not just food and agribusiness, but it's rural power, communications, you got water cooperatives, also rural community facilities, agriculture credit associations, you got a variety of customers.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So if you look across wide swaths of the upper Midwest, look at the Dakotas and Nebraska, Montana, for example. Those are just a couple of examples, but there is a very high correlation between the health and well-being of the agricultural economy and the health and well-being of the rural economy as a whole, because all of those industries, as you say, are very highly correlated and interrelated. So when one of the biggest, or the biggest in the case of agriculture, suffers, that has big knock-on effects for the economy as a whole.
You know, one thing that I'm struck by is when you were talking about how the entire agricultural industry in the U.S. had been struggling a bit or seeing a slowdown for a number of years, even before the trade tensions. I'm wondering, how much are people blaming trade for things that were already in place before those tensions emerged?
Well, that's a good question. People often everyone gets confused in the difference between causation and correlation. And people look at what's happening and they look at the headlines and the like, and it's easier to blame, you know, another country or a market thing that's beyond your control. And I'm sure that there's some of that going on. But I find in my experience that farmers and ranchers and people in the agricultural industry in the United States are some of the most thoughtful, smartest, well-informed people about what's going on in the world that you could find anywhere. And the reason for that is for two and a half decades now, we have dramatically grown our export markets. So there are lots and lots of farmers and ranchers who've been all over the world making relationships with their Chinese customers or their customers in other parts of the world. So they're pretty attentive to what's happening and the underlying causes and market factors and supply and demand factors that affect the prices for their commodities.
Well, in that case, what are they doing, or can they do anything in order to mitigate the effects of these tariff wars?
Well, I think everybody, if you go out and ask our customers or go out and ask people in rural parts of the country, you'll find, yeah, they're all doing things. Number one, they're watching it with great care, and they're trying to take it into consideration as they make their decisions for next year, for example. You know, a harvest of 2018 is done. There's a gigantic crop of agricultural commodities that's not being purchased at the moment, for example, in the case of soybeans by China. And so we have a lot of commodities with no market or an insufficient market. And farmers all over the upper Midwest, for example, are having to decide, what are they going to do next year? Are they going to grow as many soybeans as they did this year, given the state of trade relationships? Are they going to, are they going to produce less soybeans and more corn? You know, and that has big knock-on implications on seed suppliers, fertilizer suppliers, machinery manufacturers, and all those people. And farmers and ranchers are right now having to try and make decisions about what their capital structure and their business plan is going to be for 2019.
Tom Halverson, thank you so much for being with us. It's really an important area to keep an eye on, certainly as we've seen the price of soy in particular, really flipping around depending on the trade headlines. Tom Halverson is Chief Executive Officer of CoBank, joining us here where we are broadcasting live from Commonwealth's Power and Practice Alumni Workshop in Orlando, Florida. Coming up, Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. A lot to talk about, including about some of the tariffs and trade tensions. Are they easy? Are they not? What are the details? We don't know. Does it for us? I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with my co-host and colleague, Pim Fox. This is Bloomberg.
I want to turn now to one of the headline events of the day. This is really an incredible contribution from a contributor to Bloomberg Opinion, former head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, writing a column. Well, I'm going to let Clive Crook give us the details there, because he was the editor for this particular column. And Clive Crook, Bloomberg Opinion editor, joins us now from Washington, D.C. Clive, what was it like to actually
receive Lord King's column at this particular time when Brexit is coming up for a vote?
Sure. Well, it's a fantastic piece. That's the main thing to say about it, in my view. I think it's the best piece on the subject I've read. And it's a withering attack on Theresa May's Brexit deal. And he explains what's wrong with it, essentially that it gets the worst of all worlds. You know, it isn't a compromise in any meaningful sense. It sacrifices British sovereignty, and it will cause economic damage as well. So, I mean, it's a terrific piece.
Well, Clive, why is he writing this now?
Well, I mean, you know, the decision is about to be made. I'm sure he wants to influence it. He's calling on Parliament to reject the deal. And if they read the piece and think about it, I think they might well decide to do just that.
Well, and the idea being that the deal is the worst of both worlds, as you were just saying, I guess what I'm trying to understand is he trying to sort of augur for what the European Union judge just ruled, which is perhaps take a revote and try to undo Brexit altogether?
Well, I think his position in this column is not, you know, pro-Brexit or anti-Brexit. It's against this specific deal. So, you know, I think there's another, you know, it's a separate issue, really. You know, what happens next? What kind of deal Britain should seek? But the point is that this particular deal that's on the table is terrible. That's what Mervyn King is arguing. So it doesn't really go to the question of, you know, so do we have a no deal Brexit or do we stay in? That's not what he's grappling with. He's saying this particular deal is the result of, as he puts it, monumental incompetence, and he calls it a betrayal of Britain. So it's this deal that's bad. Now, the ECJ, well, it isn't an ECJ ruling. You know, it's advice from a lawyer that the ECJ usually takes very seriously. So I do think it's increased the chances that Britain could unilaterally revoke Article 50 and put the whole process on pause. But it does need to be noted that, you know, the European Commission is arguing the opposite, and the European Union's leaders are also of the view that revoking Article 50 and halting this process in its tracks would require the unanimous agreement of the other European governments. So although this advice, I think, increases the probability that the court itself will rule that a unilateral revocation is possible, it doesn't make it a done deal by any means, and the Commission and the European Union's leaders are pushing back against that view.
What has been the reaction from European leaders, and would they want Britain to come back into the European Union?
Well, that is an excellent question. I'm not sure what the answer is yet. I mean, the truth is they haven't really addressed it collectively. You know, there is no, as it were, agreed European Union view on this. Some European Union leaders have said that they want Britain to stay in. But I don't think that view would be unanimous myself. I think if Britain did revoke Article 50, I think some EU leaders might wonder if that was actually in the interest of the European Union. You know, many people in Europe are as sick of the Brexit process as many people in Britain are.
Right.
And I think they just want Britain and their complaints to go away. So
right.
I don't think, you know, Britain would be welcomed back unanimously with open arms by any means.
Well, Clive, just in 30 seconds here, I'm wondering what's the risk and how much does it go up that there is a hard Brexit or a no deal Brexit, which is a worst case scenario for
yes.
a lot of people,
yes.
if this deal is rejected?
I think it is a significant risk. I think, you know, because the problem is that it's the default option. Time is running out now. And if nothing else happens, Britain leaves the European Union on March 29th. So interventions are necessary to stop that process. And I think there is a risk, almost by accident, that Britain might decide it wants to stay after all, or it wants to slow this process down. And it might just not be possible to do that. So I think a hard Brexit is a real possibility.
Clive Crook. Thank you so much for being with us. Clive Crook, Bloomberg Opinion Editor, talking about that fabulous Mervyn King column. Mervyn King, of course, is former Bank of England governor, talking about how the current deal on the table waiting to be voted for is the worst of both worlds, arguing against voting for it. Meanwhile, perhaps there's a little bit of a glimmer saying that perhaps there's a chance for them to take a revote on Brexit.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
We are broadcasting live from Commonwealth's Power in Practice Alumni Workshop in Orlando, Florida. And we are joined by Mariana Goldenberg, founder of Curo Wealth Management. Mariana, I'm so glad that you're here because there have been a series of tax changes that have actually changed the calculus for some people, including, as we've discussed on this show, with respect to divorce, because after this year, I believe alimony payments will not be tax deductible. So I'm curious from you whether you're seeing more people taking that into account, expediting their divorces this year, and what you're expecting into year end.
Thank you, Lisa, for having me on your show. I'm very honored, and thank you, my broker-dealer, Commonwealth Financial, and Joni in particular, for having me on the show. You're absolutely right. I do see quite a bit of divorces happening today due to the changes in the tax law. Just a little bit of a background. I am a certified divorce financial analyst, which is a designation that you receive and helps you understand the laws, the divorce laws from legal standpoint, and also financial ramifications of going through divorce. As you discussed before, there are some changes happening in 2019. The alimony that used to be deductible for people paying the alimony and taxable for the receivers is no longer be taxed. So what's happening now, people are rushing in to settle their divorces before the end of the year because they will be grandfathered starting in 2019. And it's quite an interesting phenomena because people are trying to figure out the creative ways to split the assets and make sure that two parties separate for the rest of their life and stay financially strong and able to build back their resources after they go through divorce. So That's what's been happening in different areas, and I think specifically women get really shortchanged in this whole rush to do this because they don't quite understand what that means to them financially down the road. Everything looks at it today. Okay, today it's going to cost me X number of dollars in taxes. They don't look at what it will be in the future. If I settle with retirement funds, am I able to live comfortably down the road using these funds, or am I better off taking the taxable investments and create a cash flow from there? So I think that's the rush decision that unfortunately is caused by the new regulations, but I think there'll be much more creative ways of handling down the road if people spend time and look at the overall picture, not at what's happening today.
Mariana, you excuse me, you earned a degree in mathematics and finance from the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Many
yep.
people are familiar with that. How many people are familiar with the designation Certified Divorce Financial Analyst?
Thank you for asking. It's a question that I've been asked a lot. When I initially received the designation was about 8 years ago, and there are not that many of us that were doing that. today I see it much and much more. The reason I looked into this and I thought it would be very helpful for me in my practice is because as my practice matured from starting at Merrill Lynch in 1993 and spending 10 years there and another 11 at LPL, I realized that more and more of my clients are becoming women that are referring other women because they either were stay-at-home moms that needed help with finances, or they were very successful executives that were busy building their career and not having enough time spent on the financial side of it or taking or using their employer benefits to better their life. So to me, this was an ability to learn something that I didn't know on the legal side, and the ability to work with other advisors, such as their attorneys or CPAs, to make sure that as a team, we look at the well-being of people.
Just 30 seconds. I'm wondering, have you seen fewer or more women wanting to go into the advisory business?
I wish I could say I see more. It's much more than I started. The statistics are showing that when I started, there was about 5 women for each 100 female or male advisors. And right now, I've been seeing 16%, where at Commonwealth, it's a little higher. We're about 19% female advisors, which is phenomenal.
Thank you very much for being with us and sharing all this information. Much appreciated. Mariana Goldenberg is the founder of Curo Wealth Management. They are based in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. We are broadcasting from the Power in Practice Alumni Workshop for Commonwealth Financial Network in Orlando, Florida.
You're going to Disney World?
I don't think so. I think maybe our engineering expert, Charlie Vollmer, will make a trip to Disney World.
But you're wearing your Mickey Mouse ears.
No, these are my own. I know it's confusing, but these are my own. Thank you for that. We are broadcasting from the Power in Practice Alumni Workshop at Commonwealth Financial Network's annual meeting here in Orlando, Florida. Joining us now is Tim DeSetti. He is a senior partner at Infinitas. They are based in Overland, Kansas, but he joins us here on site. Tim, thank you very much for being here. I want to jump right into it because I think one of the issues that you have experience with is crucial to the industry, and that is handling consolidation and mergers. How do you put together disparate organizations that all say they want to help the client, but they have a different toolkit and maybe a different level of experience in doing that? What has been your experience?
Thank you, Pam. Yeah, it's been a fun and interesting ride over the last few years. You know, we had we had that kind of combination of perception and reality in the world in terms of a lot of the huge larger firms are perceived to be the best firms, and what we really had, strength in being associated with Commonwealth Financial Network. You know, we had a group of advisors that we really considered to be some of the best advisors in the marketplace, and we really wanted to bring a consolidated firm together so that we could, make each other better, battle some of those perceptions in the world that if you just don't have umpteen billion dollars under management, you're just not a good firm. So
how much consolidation have you seen over the past few years? I mean, has it been accelerating?
Well, Kansas City's been kind of a hotbed for that. I mean, the vast majority of the big firms are mostly doing it through acquisition, acquiring other practices, trying to get bigger. Ours was not a story of acquisition, but more of a story of just merging practices together so that we could make each other better, take advantage of talent and specialized areas of planning. But it's an absolute trend. You go across the country and talk to other advisors that everywhere people are talking about some form of.
Have you ever seen faster rates of consolidation in the industry?
I haven't. No, I mean, it's very, very prevalent in the Midwest for sure.
What kinds of back office issues do you face most when you try to combine different practices?
Well, there's always a battle of culture. You know, part of the reason is to be better for your clients, but you also want to make an environment that's better for your team. You know, we have a tremendous staff and team in Kansas City, and working together has been of benefit to them as well. So culture is a big challenge. We're all very successful financial advisors. So, getting everybody to be on one page in terms of a team vision, in terms of what we want to accomplish for our clients, what we want to accomplish in the
market. Ever have a room where they're just where you realize there's either not enough oxygen or there are too many big heads in the room?
Now, you know, I perceive that that could exist, and I know the room that we have there in Kansas City, but it's often more a story of just people looking for that greater good, greater good for one another, for their own practice, but as well for their clients. So we've had a really good go of it.
So how much is the consolidation just joining forces and sort of providing, counterpoints for one another in terms of skills and assets, and how much is trying to gain economies of scale and then downsizing in certain areas?
Yeah, absolutely. There absolutely was the reality of economy of scale. You know, looking at the numbers and saying, look, we're in a, as Matt had said before, you know, we're in a fee consolidation type industry. We want to have reasonable fees for our clients. Everybody's much more aware of fees, you know, whether it be through DOL or just through being, you know, just the fee-based progression in the business. So economy of scale was a factor. You know, we were able to consolidate a large group of firms and not really decrease our costs necessarily, but definitely not increase our costs and get more physical goods, so to speak, for the consolidation. But the bigger part of it is really the specialization, being able to work with other advisors that might specialize in special needs families, that might specialize in executive stock options, that might specialize in retirement plan, fiduciary management. So you can't be all things to all people, but with the right size firm, you can be in a better way.
What's your view of where people are taking risk where they shouldn't right now? Where are they taking risk that they shouldn't? Should people take some of their gains and be happy, or do you feel, because you know we're pretty long into the bull market?
Yeah, you know, if statistically speaking, though, you know, there's a lot of gain probably still yet to come. We're in a really good economy. I think, you know, Pim, maybe the opposite in some cases true. People have been too conservative and not, you know, and missing out. I can't replace money that you miss out if you miss out on being in the market. I have people come to me and say, you know, I've been in cash for 5 years. I'm ready now. Okay, well, I can't replace that loss in terms of your loss on the upside. So I think it's a balance, you know. Simply speaking, one of three things is going to happen. It's going to go up, it's going to go down, it's going to stay the same. You've got to have a strategy to make money in every one of those environments. And, that's the approach we're taking.
Tim Desetti, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Tim Desetti.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lisa.
Senior partner at Infinitas, talking about the rash of mergers and acquisitions, the fastest pace, Pim, that he has ever seen. We are broadcasting live from Commonwealth's Power and Practice Alumni Workshop in Orlando. Just want to get you caught up on the market, because what we are seeing is a deepening sell-off with the NASDAQ now leading the way down about 0.9%. Pam, a lot
also,
of...
Also, oil has turned lower, by the way.
Yeah.
Oil was higher, now basically unchanged, but it has turned lower in the late morning trading.
It's just interesting, and I do have to wonder, going back to what we were talking about with Dave, how much is this being driven by signals from inverting yield curves, and how much is this from some of the conflicting messages that we've gotten out of the White House with respect to how concrete a trade truce really is with the U.S. and China. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with my co-host and colleague, Pim Fox. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.